ready to keep you company wherever you are. Carte Blanche, the podcast, brings you immersive, hard-hitting stories anytime, anywhere, every week.
Another week, another installment of the Whole Week Wrap with Daily Maverick and Carte Blanche. Joining us this week is Daily Maverick Managing Editor Janet Hurd. Here's what's coming your way. The President's pala-pala predicament continues. Later, is honesty the best policy when it comes to members of parliament?
The point is that it feels like there's just not enough weight to the disclosure, the process, the consequences. What happens if you don't disclose?
Also, Table Mountain's crime problem makes headlines again. Then, vapors beware. New proposed laws are causing some serious blowback. And Olympics in South Africa? Gayton says yes. But first, how the mighty have fallen.
Janet, welcome back to the Whole Week Wrap. It's always such a pleasure having you with us. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thanks, Lizanne. It's always good to be here.
Now, I want us to start with our SAFA president, Danny Yordaan, who is once again making his appearance in court this week. Him alongside his co-accused, Trevor Neethling. They're, of course, expected back in court on fraud and theft charges after Yordaan was accused of using about 1.3 million rands in SAFA funds to pay for his personal security and PR back in 2018. Daily Maverick journalist Yanga Sibembe wrote a really excellent piece this past week detailing the soccer boss's dramatic fall from grace and kind of how he was seen as the savior of South African football, and now we're here. So what is your take on this case?
Well, I think a lot of people have been anticipating something in the works for some time. I mean, his place was raided earlier this year, and there have been a lot of allegations swirling around the SAFA boss for some time. And so, yeah, finally to see him in court, it was quite a thing. We haven't had the full docket yet. So I think we're seeing more. But basically, yeah, it's seeing a sort of very powerful person of South Africa, a soccer legend for 11 years at the head, who suddenly looked really grim in court. He's going to put up a massive case. He already has shown his intention to fight back big time. The MPA have said that they have ticked the boxes this time. I think there's more than 20 witnesses. And it's going to be very interesting to see how he can actually argue against what the case against him with this fraud and theft relating to a PR company and a security firm, which was employed a month after these allegations by the musician Jennifer Ferguson that she had been raped like literally 25 years previously. So that was the connection with that, although nothing ever came of those charges. I actually called her up after he had appeared in court and asked her if she would be interested to comment on this person who she had made those allegations against and how she felt about seeing him in court.
I want to focus a bit more on your interview with Jennifer Ferguson because I found it really insightful. She was very candid in that interview. In it, she said, quote, "He was the leader that may have started off good, but he got lost. He entered the realm of contamination and power aplenty," unquote. You say that you kind of reached out to her to talk about the court appearance, but it seems that it kind of turned into a far bigger conversation in general. Can you tell us a bit more about the interview? You touched on the fact that her rape case never really went anywhere, but how is she doing overall? How is she dealing with this renewed focus on Yordaan and as a result on her in a way?
So I was surprised that she was willing to speak because I think she does have one thing, Jennifer's very authentic. She has an authenticity about her. And she won't, I think it does display quite a bit of courage to speak out because she really doesn't need to. But she seems to have separated Yordaan from her life. You know, she lives in Sweden, and she has no contact, but she comes to visit South Africa quite a bit. But I think she captured the essence of these all-powerful figures who actually have a sense of impunity, that they can talk themselves out of anything, and how slowly you do see people actually having to face the music and be in the dock. So I think she was capturing in her comments, capturing a wider thing of a culture of what she described as masculine toxicity. And I think that, yeah, it is pervasive, we know. In the sports world, that's often where the center is. And I also appreciated the fact that she wasn't full of anger even, obviously being frustrated at the way things turned out. She also described, which I didn't really get into, she's got a Down syndrome 26-year-old daughter who she's very close to. And her daughter is incredibly kind and gentle and sees pain more than anger. And so I found that I think Jennifer plays a lot with trying to understand things in life. So yeah, I think she was very frank and showed great courage.
In February 2020, there was a robbery at a game farm in Limpopo. An indeterminate amount of cash was stolen, but some reports have indicated roughly $580,000 was taken. 2 years later, this case made national headlines as the farm in question was revealed to be that of President Cyril Ramaphosa. Now, nearly 5 years later, the Palapala scandal shows no signs of simmering down.
Another big case playing itself out before the Constitutional Court is the infamous Palapala case, or Farmgate, whatever you want to call it. Firstly, what are some of the main arguments given by the ATM and the EFF in this latest Palapala court battle?
Well, first of all, this has taken quite a while to come to court, which is obviously the argument that's being used by Parliament to try and throw the case out, because it has taken, I think, 14 months before the EFF actually went ahead with the action. So it does start to feel like the Parliament thing is a saga that's never going to go away. But the issues are really that they felt that Parliament should not have set aside the report on the inquiry and actually gone ahead with processes against the President, feeling that there was enough evidence to go ahead with a case against the President to answer, which was shut down by the ANC committees and the ANC in Parliament. And I think that's where the decision was taken. So the EFF and various other parties have actually used that to say, no, this shouldn't have happened. So this needs to get set aside. And it's gone to the Con Court because they're saying it was unconstitutional for Parliament to do that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where it's going to play out. I think that Parliament came out quite heavy saying that the problem is the lateness, in that the sixth Parliament has actually already ended, that in fact the process can't really come back, that they really waited too long, and that to resuscitate a motion cannot happen because it's now the next administration. So I think that's going to be one of the challenges for parties like the EFF to prove that, you know, that's a technical issue. But yeah, and it all relates back to the robbery at Palapala in 2020, which was exposed by Arthur Fraser. There are a lot of questions remaining about Fraser's testimony. I personally think there is a need for some sort of process that really gets to grips with exactly, you know, transparency there.
Absolutely, because, you know, you can't have your president being implicated throughout his entire term in any regard. So you do need him and his government to bring the public into his confidence and be like, these are the facts, this is what's happening, and that's it. Because honestly, it certainly didn't help that Ramaphosa also at first seemingly avoided answering questions on the Palapala matter, but then also missing several deadlines to submit explanations to both the NPA and the SA Reserve Bank. So I think a lot of people are looking at that also as, what are you avoiding and why are you trying to be secretive almost? That's how they're interpreting that. So I agree with you. We definitely need clarity on this. But we can't get into all of that today because it's such a hugely complex case, you know, with a lot of moving parts, lots of characters. I would suggest our listeners head on over to the Daily Maverick website. Victoria O'Regan from Daily Maverick has done a fantastic timeline with all the supporting documents and links to past articles and all of that to help you really understand how it all unfolded, because it's a lot to unpack.
It was a list meant to ensure greater transparency when it came to politicians' various private interests. But it seems some political figures aren't being completely honest when it comes to disclosing their assets and any gifts received on the annual register of members' interests. So, is honesty truly the best policy?
Daily Maverick's Rebecca Davis wrote a piece this past week in which she really questions whether politicians are actually taking this whole list seriously. Can you take us through her article a little bit? What were some of the main findings in her piece?
Well, one of the main things, and I mean, Rebecca often does, she's also taken a poke at the IEC's, you know, the release of those, the quarterly political funding, political party funding of the IEC that now has to be done. And she pointed out, how it doesn't appear that there is actually full disclosure, and some are disclosing and others aren't. And I think it's the same here. I think this assets register has obviously been going for longer for MPs, always been there. And there's always a lot of excitement, you know, obviously interest in what are people disclosing. But somehow there always feels like there's something missing again. And I think what Rebecca found, basically pointed out, is that of the 17 political party leaders who were sworn in as MPs in the 7th Parliament, 4 don't own any shares and don't own any properties. Now, this might be so. I mean, I know she got a response from one of them, John Steenhuisen, who said that he rented his apartment or for house in Sea Point. Don't think she got a response from the others. But the point is that it feels like there's just not enough weight to the disclosure of the process. The consequences, what happens if you don't disclose? And I think that's one of the weaknesses that she pointed out with the parliamentary spokesperson, you know, saying it, yes, it is actually, it's an honor system. It's basically asking people to do the right thing. And as we have experienced, our honorable members are not always the most honorable and they don't always disclose everything.
Yes.
You know, and they're earning a salary, a startup of 1.2 million rand a year. And that's just, I mean, they still get all sorts of perks, you know, around that. And that is public funds. So I do feel like perhaps it seems to be a little bit of a kind of event that happens and lip service is paid to it. And some are very honest, but others, you know, find ways. And there's also ways and means to hide funds, as we know. I'm not sure that the MPs actually are really, really doing what they are meant to be doing in answering those questions.
As you've pointed out, parliamentary spokesperson Moloto Motapo said that, you know, it's essentially an honor system and that, quote, unintended omissions might occur during the data entry process. This kind of made me wonder that maybe then, you know, because as you've said, politicians have a rather flexible relationship with the truth, that sometimes in this declaration process, they might intentionally try and omit stuff. So now my question is that should we then just kind of review the whole declaration process to ensure there's less room for politicians to make, quote, unintended omissions?
Yes, I think, Lizanne, we definitely can tighten up. I think always, I think it's shown that there is clearly something not 100% there, that it's relying too much on the goodwill of MPs. There has to be a disclosure, but consequences for non-disclosure. I'm not sure that Parliament has actually come to grips with that at all and can definitely find ways to ensure this transparency and ensure full disclosure.
The festive season is upon us, and with that comes an influx of avid nature lovers eager to explore Cape Town's Table Mountain and surrounds. Unfortunately, over the years, parts of the picturesque Table Mountain National Park have become crime hotspots.
It's certainly not a new thing. Carte Blanche has done several stories on this. Daily Maverick has reported on this for many years, and both of us have covered the different strategies by authorities to address this. But particularly brutal attacks have really shown a dramatic spike in recent years. And they seem to be spilling over into various suburbs along the Cape Coast at this point. The most recent case that you made me aware of involved a German couple that was mugged in Kalk Bay. Can you tell us a little bit more about this? What grabbed your attention with this specific story?
You know, it's one of those stories that if you live in Cape Town, it's kind of always there. But obviously, there's often a spike during the build-up to the holiday period, which is what happened last year. And, you know, I'm a keen hiker myself, and I like to, you know, you just like to feel that you can actually go with your mates and not actually worry at all if you go to Echo Valley, for instance. And it's just these beautiful spaces of nature and the environment that should be tranquil, peaceful places that you can just suddenly have to face the reality that you do need to safeguard yourself when you go on these hikes. Mm. Or if you go on a cycle. And it does mean that hiking alone is really not really advisable. And the question again is, how safe is the mountain? And no one's really able to answer that, because some areas seem to be quite safe, but then they'll suddenly spike, and then there'll be extra monitoring, and then they'll put in a whole lot of resources and a whole lot of integrated efforts and operations with the city and sand parks and the FAPs. But it does tend to come and go in terms of the pattern. Often it's what's being reported and what's not. A lot of people don't even go to the police and report incidents. So it's quite haphazard to actually get a feel for what's really going on the mountain.
You've also shared a very sobering interactive map detailing really all the reported cases. I have to emphasize that these are reported cases of crime on Table Mountain and in Table Mountain National Park since 2018. And I mean, when you open it up, it is just littered with markers indicating various crimes ranging from attempted muggings, assaults, vehicle theft, arson, and really everything in between. It's just quite a shocking visualization of what's actually happening. So what does this map reveal about crime in the area and kind of this fluctuation that you've just referred to of crime in the area?
Yes. I mean, there's actually apparently various, heat maps on the mountain crime. And this one is by someone called Andre. And I know the Daily Maverick has interviewed him in the past. He basically just tracks where these incidents are happening and what type of incidents. Is it an attempted mugging or a suspicious approach or a mugging or an actual arson? And then it just shows you where the trends are. And the trends, there are hotspots. There are definite hotspots. And then it can help people, I think, to look and navigate. And one would just also imagine, though, that the authority would be keeping this kind of data. I don't see this kind of mapping as seriously as sort of these interested parties. Mm. And I do think that's where their coordination could really help to track trends. But I do think, yeah, this feels to me like trackers, monitors, just more observation points, perhaps some more CCTV cameras. But just to really sort of try and find ways to watch, when are they networks? When is it just opportunistic crime? And when is it a real network of crime, like a syndicate operating, which would be very helpful to try and get to the bottom of that. So that we're entering the holiday season now, and that's also why, I mean, now these were German tourists, so obviously that immediately creates an alarm, and then next minute you have advisories put out by various governments to warn people. So we've got to be super careful about our reporting as well, that we're reporting accurately and fairly, and that it is exactly what we say, because I think there's a lot at stake here, and I do think the city of Cape Town argues that it doesn't have control of the mountain, and they try and work together. But it sometimes feels like it just slips through the cracks because it's a multiple responsibility. There's got to be better ways to provide safety and make the mountain safe.
Now, we've provided a link to the map in today's episode description for those wanting to take a closer look, or even if you unfortunately have an incident to share. So do check that out.
New vaping laws are on the table for South Africans as the Tobacco Products and Electronic Delivery Systems Control Bill aims to classify vapes or e-cigarettes as tobacco products. It will override the current Tobacco Control Act, and vapers could face hefty fines or even prison time. But is government perhaps jumping the gun?
This will essentially mean that you will no longer be able to use a vape in public. And I can't help but wonder whether this will actually result in less smokers, because the data seems to be quite unclear.
Yes, Lizanne, I mean, I think that's the case with all these things. Like, if you crack down, will people find other routes to access? And will it make any difference? I think, frankly, I mean, it feels to me like, why is vaping being left out for so long? Why has vaping been allowed for so long to just operate almost it seems like, you know, because it's not as publicly offensive as smoking. And I'm speaking as an ex-smoker here. It's sort of socially almost acceptable because it doesn't smell. You can actually be with the person and it won't offend you or it won't upset you. And I think that's perhaps why there has been more tolerance of it. But actually, I personally, you know, looking at it very probably unscientifically, it just seems to me the damage that these liquids can cause are substantial. Lung damage, heart problems, fertility issues, chemicals, nicotine, you know, it's the same thing. So why? I don't really understand why they've actually been excluded from the same regulations as smoking.
Yes.
So it seems almost like the law is now going to catch up with the vaping industry, which has been allowed to flourish in the vacuum. But I can understand the concerns around vaping, although, you know, people have to look after their own health and make their own decisions. And so, yeah, and I think the harm, the chemicals, the damage is quite clear. So I think it feels to me like it's going to be quite a hard battle to fight this one. And I know it's been going for a few years now. So I think we're heading for the same sort of restrictions as smoking.
Yes. And, you know, we did a story on vaping not too long ago. It was a couple of years back. And I remember we spoke to two teenagers and they both said, you know, they cannot start their day without vaping first thing in the morning before school. It has to happen. So clearly it has an impact. And I think at most, if the regulations can just better control the use of vapes or e-cigarettes by the youth, that would already be a huge improvement because you see it in the schools. At least if they can start there, that would be a great thing.
But there's also the question of whether there's this argument that people to stop smoking become vapers. And I think the research there is also not clear about, you know, do they actually stop?
South Africa has its eye on the Olympics, the 2036 Olympic Games, that is. With proposals already submitted and negotiations in full swing, could we become the first African country to host this iconic sports event?
Last week, Sport, Arts and Culture Minister Gayton McKenzie confirmed that we've officially shown interest to host this massive sporting event. And the International Olympic Committee has said, great, we're very happy that they've given us a proposal saying that it could one day lead to the first Olympic Games in Africa, which I think this might very well be something that we could pull off. I mean, we've seen that Gayton has the gears that we need for these kinds of things. So who knows?
Absolutely. I mean, wouldn't it be great in 12? I mean, it just seems like a long time away, but these things do require planning. It's a long road ahead to actually getting them, but I think it would be fantastic. And it would be such a lot of effort that goes into these things. And I recall the terrible disappointment after losing in the 2004 Games, which ended up in Athens. Gayton McKenzie is not shy to say things are going to happen. And
certainly not.
What he says is not necessarily what is going to happen by any means. But I think it is a fantastic thing. And we're such a sporting nation. And so I would certainly rally behind it. I think it's a good cause. And just for Africa, I mean, the fact that it has never happened in Africa is quite astonishing, really.
Yes.
So if it's not South Africa, I see Egypt was also on the cards to be bidding.
I also just want to add that a lot of people are saying, oh, but where are we going to find the money? We can't afford this. But I also want to highlight that the Olympic Committee itself has really given the bidding process and the funding model quite a dramatic overhaul in recent years, because the same kind of question and argument kept cropping up from various countries. So they say that the actual cost of hosting the games is now down by nearly 80% in some instances. So really, it is an investment opportunity for the country, I think. And I think we just might have some promise to get this. So really, let's see what happens.
Absolutely. And we can put some of our, what was seen as white elephants from the 2010 World Cup, we can put those to good use and really, really, we can build on that and not start afresh.
There we go. See, we've already written half of the proposal. But Janet, that's unfortunately all we have time for this week. Thank you for making the time to chat to us. And since we are now officially in December, I also want to just take this time to really wish you a peaceful and a happy festive season. And I hope that your new year is just off to an amazing start.
Thank you very much, Nizan, and to the listeners, to a great December.
Thanks for listening. Catch us again next week for another Whole Week Wrap. Until then, why not join the conversation on Twitter, Facebook, and everywhere else? We always love hearing from you.